probably end up with more varieties of ketchup by the end of this century than we will languages.
The next time I see you, remind me not to talk to you, will you?
Welcome to Radio Free School.
Chinese.
Not sure. Less than a year for the one classes every week. And I did the summer camp. And the summer camp is where I learned this Chinese poem.
What do you like about Chinese?
Well, because you know how to say French. So I just thought I might as well take Chinese lessons because I wanted to speak a different language so me and Bronwyn can have secret discussions while we say it out loud in front of you.
How about the written form? What do you think of the way it's written?
I think it's nice.
Isn't it very hard?
No, I don't think it's very hard. 赐给妈妈我爱我的妈妈负责了好事妈妈把我夸奖我有了缺点妈妈把我克服 I'm not going to read anything else. I'm going to say it because I've memorized it. It's called Qiu Shiu Shu. That means small, small hands. 我有一双小小手，一只做了一只鸭，小小手，小小手，一共是五手指头。你好means hello, and 再见 means bye, and 你好吗 means how are you doing, and 谢谢 means thank you. Yeah, I like Chinese a lot.
Any Chinese friends?
There is one. Called Mei Ling, and she just visited us today, 2004, August 3rd.
I'm a professor at McMaster University in the departments of anthropology and in modern languages and linguistics. You had an excellent question from one of your children, I think, where does a certain word come from? And I think the question as to why we speak and how we speak and where language comes from is something that very young children who are, of course, burdened with the task of learning language. Very young children are fascinated by this issue. It's a natural question. It's almost a universal question, as far as I can tell. It's been around for a long, long time. And I think that efforts to answer the question have been made or attempted for several hundred years. We're now in a stage where we think we can make some plausible answers that can give us insight into things. I think the question the child asks, why do I call this an apple, or why do you call this milk, mommy, or something like that, these are the kinds of questions that we can answer in the sense that we can say, well, English refers to that liquid as milk, and Russian calls it molokha, and Greek calls it galaktos, lactus in Latin, so forth. We can point to other languages. We say, well, you know, there's some kind of lurking similarities here. We'll compare all these words across these languages, and we'll look at some others, And lo and behold, we can retrieve an ancient language, a forgotten language, that is the ancestor of all those different present-day or historical languages. And mm-hmm. that's historical linguistics. People have been doing that now for roughly 200 years with enormous success, a very, very sophisticated area of linguistic work. But in a way, that's a different question. That's not the same question as why do we talk and what is what we're doing? What is language and how have we evolved language?
My daughter was saying, can we do without language? Can't we, you know, we don't need language. I said, well, how are we going to communicate? So there was the idea of like communication that, you know,
well,
the different forms.
Yeah, that is one of the important branches, more like the anthropological branch of our approach to trying to answer the question of language evolution. And it is tied in intimately with the evolution of our intellectual capacity, our ways in which we look at the world, our social structure, our natural tendency to seek out and form social units. And it's felt, I think, correctly by my colleagues in anthropology that this is a very promising area in which to explain the evolution of language. I think a very prominent worker there is Terence Deacon at Berkeley, who has a book and discusses the evolution of the mind and the evolution of the symbolic systems that represent that mind. So you can't really have a mind, you can't really have a society without having language. But curiously, you can do an enormous amount of stuff without language. You have music, and you can put whole groups in kind of rapture with music. You have mathematics, and you can do very elaborate reasoning with equations that no one actually pronounces. So there are alternatives to language that in some way hover out there, sort of make you wonder what's going on here. Perhaps they're derived from language. George Lakoff, again at Berkeley, is a linguist who's looked at the origins of math or how math evolves. I myself have pondered some of those issues. Music is, say, Ray Jackendoff down at MIT, Massachusetts Institute of Technology. He's worried very much. He's was a conductor and a linguist, or is a conductor and a linguist, and wonders very much about whether music is some kind of language, some modification of language. But in a way, unless we can figure out what language is and how we got it, I think these other questions about music or math or whatever, these are going to have to wait. We're not going to be able to answer those. We probably started out with something close, I would say, to 10,000 languages. That's a high number. Most of my colleagues would put it lower. But at the period of colonial expansion 300 or 400 years ago, I think we may have had 10,000 languages on the planet. The estimates today are between 3 and 6. And, of course, we will probably end up with more varieties of ketchup by the end of this century than we will languages. The rate things are dying. As societies pull in and integrate and form larger functioning amalgams of trade and culture, they tend to focus in on one language, and the smaller ones die. We do have some zones in the world where people speak 5 or 6 languages routinely, depending upon where they are and what they have to do, and they seem to get by just fine. But in most cases, that's exceptional, and the languages die. I myself learned a language called Ubuk because of very elaborate language from the Caucasus Mountains, and I think now that I'm one of the very few people that can talk to a few others in Ubuk, maybe 3 people on Earth, although the other 2 native speakers are trying very desperately to revive it among the community. Languages have functions. They have functions, say, as a home language or a function as a trade language. We don't think that way with English because it seems everywhere. But in other parts of the world, languages fall into very very clear categories like that. So languages are dying if they fail to meet their function. And with those languages go different views of the world. What amazed me and really pulled me into linguistics as a young man was learning to read and think in ancient Greek. Which I was forced to do against my will, very much so. And I was astounded that they thought differently. They saw things differently. They had advantages, conceptual speed or elegance in certain areas that English lacked. It was startling, a startling experience. And it gets more and more that way the further you get from, say, one particular vantage point. If you're, say, speaking Chinese and you wander further and further, you see a very different world. Conversely, if you start with English and go, say, toward Chinese, again, it looks very different. And when every one of these tiny little languages dies, we lose all that. Languages are hard, even for linguists. They're very difficult. They're a lot of work. And people approach them perhaps with grand ambitions of keeping them alive, like Manx, reviving them like Cornish. But it's a lot of work, and it's a lot of time. And some people at some point say, it's just not worth it. Let's get on with life. Let's continue our careers. But it is a loss, and the problem is the loss can't be appreciated if you're outside the language. It's hard to give a sense of the loss. If you see a species, a beautiful bird, go extinct, well, you can appreciate the loss. But when some small language like Ubuk dies, it's very difficult to convey what's gone.
I'm Noam Chomsky. You're listening to Radio Free School on CFMU 93.3.
The problem the child faces is guessing the grammar of the language that the parent is throwing at her or him. And that's really, you can be shown in logical terms and in mathematical terms virtually. That's an extremely difficult problem that the child cannot solve unless the range of choices that the child faces are very limited. So every generation has a slightly different grammar. Every individual has a slightly different grammar. And over a period of generations, that kind of accumulated noise and change makes a different language. So the language of English now is really not the language of Shakespeare, even though they have come down in a line, mouth to mouth, over the centuries. And we don't understand a lot of what he's saying. I will ear the earth, I think Hamlet says that. What does he mean, ear the earth? Ear is the old verb for plowing. And earth, in fact, is like moon, month, something like that. Long length, it's one of these English words with th on the end. It's based on the verb for plow. It's that which was plowed. I will ear the earth. You know, who knows? You know, no one in the audience gets that unless there's some linguist. I think Chomsky's one of his most brilliant insight. His chief brilliant insight was that a child does this with ease and does a superb job at this very rapidly. In an environment that is totally unstructured and where all kinds of weird little things are being said, incomplete things, things that never quite repeat themselves. And that child will pick up, form a grammar, understand as they pick up that grammar, say of English or whatever they're exposed to, that certain things cannot be said, even though they've never been told that you can't say that. Once in a while it happens. Well, no, you don't say that. That's not the way we say. But generally, they know other things that prohibit mistakes. And he said it's an instinct. It's built in. We have a natural capacity as a particular species to acquire something that we call language. And we do it at a certain period in life, early in life. We now think there's some evidence, and neurological evidence in the last few years, that perhaps if you're exposed to more than one language, you have an extra cortical area in your left side of your brain that helps you pick up other languages later in life. Most of my colleagues in linguistics have been exposed as children to other languages. It's very common. It's a widespread belief, and it frequently means that in immigrant families, they will refuse to teach a child one of the languages. They insist the child grow up, say, speaking the language of the community to which they've immigrated. That's a very common one. I think Toronto now has 180-something immigrant groups, ethnic groups, very, very rich ethnic pattern in Toronto, many, many languages. I would say that 100 years from now, there will probably be only 3 or 4 of those languages still spoken. Again, the issue of use, function, and all that. But I don't think the child is made stupid by speaking several languages. If anything, the opposite is true. But there is a problem, and that is that once the child hits puberty, the language acquisition capacity, like a good biological organ of some sort, seems to shut down, and for most people. And at that stage, they really seem to have to focus on one language if they're to learn a trade or learn a profession, become educated beyond primary school. The idea of what will secondary and post-secondary education be taught in, which language, that actually is a crucial issue. And people who, beyond puberty, try to become educated into languages often have trouble. So So frequently polyglot and people who speak many languages, they're really educated in one, they reason in one, and the others are there for social function. So there's a fight, a great struggle on the part of various First Nation communities as to whether to maintain their language, how much resources to put into maintenance of language. Because again, if you're born, say, a Mohawk, but you've spoken English, when you come to Mohawk, say, at the age of 30, it's an arbitrary age, but beyond, well beyond puberty, and you say, I want to learn a language of my forefathers, a language of my ancestors, foremothers, I guess we don't have that word, but I want to learn Mohawk. It's extremely difficult. It's a very rich, very complex language. And if you come as an adult, you presumably have to work somewhere. You'll have to do it in the evenings. It's going to be a big, big job. And I think a lot of the First Nation peoples who are adults find this a very difficult task. And those communities that try to direct it at the children are probably doing the right thing. But then the children all want to be modern. They want to be do what the other kids are doing and so forth. This makes the child, in many cases, an unwilling individual, an unwilling student. The best place to learn a language is simply at the dinner table with your family, talking about issues that concern us, because as a family, say, because a language carries an enormous emotional baggage with it. And the linguists really have no way of even beginning to describe how it does this. But if you have dreams, if you have strong feelings that are associated with the language, that are expressed through that language will always be with you, and you will want that language, even if it's not something you're going to be able to use in the store or in the office. So some of these languages, I think, will survive as root languages, languages for heritage, for the family, for the community, but there will be a limited role. Most of them, many, many have died. It's a tremendous intellectual loss for the species, and probably some more will die. But I have noticed in the course of my own career in the last 20 years that many, many of the tribes now have taken the issue of language survival much more seriously, and some of the brightest, most energetic members of those communities have decided to devote a lot of effort to documenting the language and, if possible, salvaging it, saving that language. Languages can go extinct and be revived if they are thoroughly documented. They won't be the same, exactly, but as I said before, even between two generations, no language remains the same. So it may be a somewhat more exaggerated version of such a change. The Czech language nearly went extinct in the early 19th century and was revived by nationalists. It is now a perfectly stable, functioning language. Whether that fate can await some others that are threatened, it's hard to say.
Are we creating language?
Well, create language all the time. I just did it a minute or two ago when I said foremothers. We create words all the time. As need arises, we have some new concepts, some new problems, some new technique. It could be something very concrete, like a new gadget or a fruit or something. It can be something more abstract that comes up. But we have an innate capacity and talent to make up new words. And we can even change grammatical rules slightly. So everyone says now between you and I. And for my generation, it was between you and me. So things slightly altered. They drift. This is the normal process. But in extreme situations, we have a few cases of children who were grossly neglected, grew up in isolation, but were together, and have devised their own languages. And I had a student some 25 years ago, a young woman from the Caribbean, who had a fraternal twin, had a brother, and they were not abused at all, but they were very close as twins, and between them, they developed another language of their own, despite the fact that they were growing up perfectly normally speaking English from, I can't remember the island, but they spoke English, native English, first language, and they made up their own language. So if you try hard, apparently you can make up your own language. So we can do that too. And that's quite a feat, because a language is an enormously complex system. And Chomsky had that insight that we can do that. We're able to pull it off, and we pull it off naturally, and we do a pretty good job. It's something that's really very daunting, very challenging. I think we are naturally curious. We naturally tend to learn various various sorts of expertise, various things, whether it's how to get various types of fruit if we're a hunting-gathering society, or how to stalk the good eating animals, the good game animals, or whether it's theoretical physics or linguistics, or how to make money on the stock market. We are naturally inclined to have organized knowledge. And the truth is that language really cannot be taken apart from that. That to have language, you have to have something to talk about. That's the anthropological approach, that goes hand in hand with the evolution of our culture. And they go out and they look for signs in the ancient past that, yes, these people are organizing their society at a certain level of complexity. Therefore, they must have had some type of mind and communication strategies that allow them to organize and maintain that society.
You are listening to Radio Free School on CFMU.
Writing is a difficult question, and I think that no one really understands precisely why we write and write so readily. It's obvious that writing is very, very new in comparison to the history of the species, that we're much older than writing, and our languages are probably much older than writing. And it's here that probably the anatomical fact that the motor area for hand control and the motor area for speech control are next to each other. And some people have even said that there was something about making tools or using the hands that also gave rise to language. That we went from an animal call system to some kind of very fancy grammar because we were making things. And that's why the speech area is right next to the hand area, why we still gesture all the time as we talk and so forth. At some point or other, we were able to start making little signs with those hands, like a little tool, but now an abstract tool, or a tool on paper or on stone, that helped us keep track of our ideas and pass on information to our descendants, our children. And eventually this became writing. We can see it evolving. It's about 5,000 years old, maybe a little older, and it is a field in itself. There are various forms of writing. Some have advantages over others. Now, today in the world, there are three forms that still survive, but they're all the different alphabets, and very, very beautiful, very elaborate, that have spread out from a number of centers in the past. There are people that have trouble writing and trouble recognizing. They flip D and B, or a P and B, and that kind of stuff. And that's very, very common. And often those people are very bright. There are several approaches now to the actual evolution of language. I think that sometime in the next 20 or 30 years, we'll have a very clear idea of how it evolved. And I think that there are several schools of pursuit. There are the anthropologists who are looking at how symbols and language and culture all sort of seem to progress through the centuries or through the eras, the thousands of years, hundreds of thousands of years. There are people who are looking at genetics of speech and comparing our genetics to those of our near relatives, the apes, and trying to work out the genetic issues of how language has evolved. That's a very complex problem. I myself look at it more as a logical problem. I simply take an animal call system, I say that's the starting point, and I say you're going to go from that to some kind of grammar. Somehow you're going to have a system that allows you to create structure, and with that structure comes mind. And I want to write that theory up. It's been kicking around about 20 years. I want to write it up now and send it off later this year. But the idea that we had no useful language history, that it was just something that we'd never understand, I think that idea is now past. I think that we have a lot of phoneticians that have been looking at this. The phoneticians have spearheaded this kind of work now since Philip Lieberman back in the early 70s to try to figure out how we go from the hooting and hollering we hear with things like chimpanzees to what we're talking. And actually, in terms of phonetics, English is quite simple. We've got some languages that are far more complicated. And that somehow this is correlated with the very peculiar changes that have taken place in the human face and throat. We have a unique throat. We have a shape of face and a long pharynx, a throat down to the larynx there in our neck. No other animal has this. And so some very peculiar evolutionary pressures were at work just anatomically, and they had phonetic consequences that also led to language. And we can make hundreds and hundreds of noises, distinct noises. Our ancestors couldn't. They could probably only make three or four. It was simply an anatomical, hard, physical limitation. And that's a very important fact in the evolution of language. So we now have a whole bunch of independent, basically independent lines of inquiry that are quite sophisticated. And I think we, at some point soon, we will know. I think we'll have a very good idea of how it evolves.
I like to hear the sounds you're making and all the words that you're saying when you talk to me. Babies make themselves understood. It's either dime for time or time for food, with waving arms or a crying voice. They talk, talk, talk. I like to listen to you talk, talk. I like to hear the sounds you're making and all the words that you're saying when you talk to me. One day you'll learn your alphabet, and that is something you won't forget. English, Spanish, French to Greek, we talk. To say what you think and tell stories, pretend or real. You learn that the most important words come out when you say what you feel. Person to person, phone to phone, do you talk to yourself when you're all alone? In a whisper as quiet as a mouse, talk, talk, talk. Talk, talk, talk. Talk, talk. I like to listen to you talk, talk. I like to hear the sounds you're making and all the words that you're saying. Communicating when you talk, talk. I like to listen to you talk, talk. I like to hear the sounds you're making and all the words that you're saying when you talk to me. Listen to you talk, talk. I like to listen. I like to
listen. My name is Evelina Kay. I'm just going to read like two things in Chinese, okay? So gay mama, what I want to mama, what zola house mama, ba wu kwa jian, what yola kwa jian. Mama bang wu ke fu, wo sheng le bing mama ru ye kan he, qing ai de mama tian tian gan qing wo de chang zong.
Why did you want to learn Chinese for?
Well, I don't know. I just wanted to learn Japanese, but they didn't teach it at the free language class, so then I chose Chinese. I just like the characters, like the origami, like things like that. I've had two different teachers.
Is it hard? Is learning Chinese
not
difficult?
Not really. I don't find it too difficult.
When you do a character, does that mean it's a word?
Yeah, it's like a word. You not just like a letter, it's like a word. E is one of the kind of E's. There's a lot of different ones. I found that out when I took a few lessons, I found that out. Like there's a lot of shers, like 10, all sorts of ones. So you can never, you have to say exactly right with the proper pronunciation, otherwise you might be saying a totally different word.
Is there any other language you want to learn?
I don't want to learn French, but...
Why don't you?
Everyone wants me to, that's why.
Why don't you want to learn French?
I don't know, I think it's because everyone wants me to. In my old class, none of them were Chinese, except maybe one or two.
Do you think you learnt more Chinese being among Chinese people?
Not exactly, I don't think so. I didn't really pick up too much in that other class. And the ones that were every day for a month, I didn't really pick up too much. I think it's because I never knew what the teacher was saying.
Do you ever make up languages? Any words, Amina? Did you make it?
Not very much. I was making my own. It's really very weird. One of them, I made E an arrow, and I made F a different kind of arrow. I made different kinds of things.
You invented a written language?
Yeah, but I didn't. I never remember it. So I always have to look in my diary when I want to write something down in it. I have the same amount of alphabet as the other ones so that people can actually translate the language. And so I've got like the A, B, C, D, E, F, G, H, and everything like that.
What's your language called?
Evelinish.
Can you say a word in Evelinish?
Well, I didn't make words. I mean numbers, well, but I can't really describe them that well because you have to see them to really know what I mean. My work was always so crammed and jammed because I was when I was younger when I did that. I think I'll have to put it in a new book. The end!
I'm gonna wrap myself in paper. I'm gonna daub myself with glue. Stick some stamps on the top of my head. I'm gonna mail myself to you.
Contact Radio Free School at grassroots@hwcn.org or mail P.O. Box 19, 1280 Main Street West, Hamilton, Ontario, Canada, L8S1CO.